Welcome to the Business of Security podcast, episode number 7. Your host today is Chad Beckman. Today, he'll be talking with Alan Alford, Chief Information Security Officer at Mitel Corporation. Now, let's get to it.
What does the industry need to start talking about that we're not doing today?
Information technology is built on a horrible foundation. If we could sort of redo and start from the beginning, we would be so much better off.
If you don't invest in it and keep it running, it will blow up.
We also have to be able to go in with solutions, not just problems. We have a long way to go if we're going to win this fight.
At the end of the day, educated people are really the best countermeasure against all the threats.
Alan, welcome to the Business of Security podcast. I appreciate you joining us today. And today, Alan Alford is the CISO of Mitel Corporation, is going to share with us some insights on GDPR for the security leader. And he's been speaking about this subject for a number of weeks, perhaps a few months. I'll let him speak to that. But Alan, welcome. I'd like to learn a little bit more about you.
Thank you. It's good to be here. About me, let's see here. I'm CISO at Mitel. Prior to that, I was CISO at Forcepoint, and I've also been CISO at Polycom. So I've done unified communications. I've done security. I've been a product information security officer in the education space, as well as at Polycom. I built their product security program. So I've got a pretty broad security background, probably 50-50 split between enterprise and product side, with a lot of cloud thrown in, obviously. And that's pretty much my background. In terms of GDPR, I've been working on the problem for about a year and a half total now. So as to why I'm speaking about it, I guess it's I wanted to share the pain. the real story is, you know, the May 25th deadline came, and I think a huge number of people weren't ready for it. And I think there's a lot of folks that are still panicking. I think there's a lot of folks that are still just doing the ostrich thing and burying their heads in the sand and hoping this won't impact them. And by a lot of folks, I mean, they've actually measured it. There was an entity called Crowd Research that did a survey, did a whole study, and they interviewed quite a few folks about their GDPR readiness. And they released their study, I want to say on May 23rd. It was like, you know, 2 days before the deadline. They came out and said, here's where we're at as a collective community. And a full 60% of participants weren't ready yet. 7% were fully ready at that time. And another, what does that work out to? 33% were heading the right direction and going to get there pretty quick, kind of a statement. So yeah, it's still on everyone's mind. The deadline has come and passed, and if you haven't been fined yet, you know, you've still got a chance to get compliant and get your ducks in a row here. So it's not too late is really my message. Get on this now. It's involved. It takes some real time and some real effort. But it's never too late to start and get moving, because we don't know who the first, you know, fines are going to be. Well, I think there's some talk now about who the first fine is going to be, but it could be you. So get on it. That's sort of my message today.
So it sounds like then, you know, you're newer to Mitel. So you started this with your previous employer as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is going to be kind of your second go around with another company doing GDPR rollout. And
I'm knee deep in it and have been for, you know, a year and a half now.
So what is the number one thing that security leaders need to really pay attention to? Because a lot of people are saying, you know, GDPR is certainly a security aspect to it, but they look at it perhaps more of maybe the privacy officer's role or the compliance officer's role.
Right. Sure. So one of the things GDPR calls for is you have to appoint a DPO, a data protection officer. And this person is the representative authority within the company as for, you know, implementing and complying. And this person is also the entity who reports out to the government. If there's a violation, the DPO is the one who goes and reports that violation up. So the DPO role is pretty critical. In my experience, the DPO role is best suited to be somebody from the legal department, right? Because this is ultimately about complying with a law, and this is ultimately about dealing with the law and reporting to legal authorities, right? So at the end of the day, your DPO should really be somebody with a legal focus. Now, that being said, how are you going to actually implement? What are the controls you're going to put in place? How are you going to get there? It is clearly not in the DPO's bailiwick, right? If you appoint somebody from the legal department, you're going to have a corresponding role who's a technologist who understands protection, right? So that seems to me, and the most obvious circumstance, that that's going to fall on the CISO, not the CIO, because it's not just technology in general, it's the technologies of protection, data protection. So in my mind, the CISO and the DPO have to be joined at the hip, basically.
How does that relationship really begin? Because GDPR, I feel as if it is almost spearheading, or may I say even forcing, that relationship to really become established, where in the past it was sort of a neighborly wave, you know.
Right.
High privacy. I'm over here doing security, but now there has to be a much tighter integration on initiatives and efforts, and clearly.
Sure. And I think the most critical thing is you bring all the players and you sit them down, because it can't just be the DPO and the CISO either, right? You have to have everybody involved. Who are the data owners, right? Who are the data process owners? Who you know? So you've got a number of folks sitting around the table. You've got HR there. You've got marketing there. You've got the IT applications guys there. You've got the database administrators there. You've got a whole group of people, none of whom really speak a common language, right?
Exactly.
And so really the first step is to establish that relationship where the DPO is sort of the GDPR to business translator. Mm-hmm. And the CISO is sort of the technology to GDPR translator. And all the players have to come to the table, and all the players have to communicate. And you're going to be learning new terms. You're going to be learning new ways of thinking. This is not easily done, right?
So it sounds like the best way to do it, the way you described it, is kicking this initiative off, is getting all of those key roles, those key players into a room, and sort of sorting through what is ahead, establishing the project effort, because this really is a project to begin with anyway, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you'll need all those players at key points throughout, right? Again, you know, it's about data protection, and protection is in the CISO's realm, and you're going to have to, you know, the single most critical step, the biggest hurdle to overcome, the hardest challenge to get through when you're building a GDPR program is simply understanding where the data is, what data you have, where it is, and how it flows through your systems, right? Data inventory and data flow mapping are really the most critical hurdles. And
Article 30, I think that is, out of GDPR.
I believe that's right. I believe that's 30. And it's the beginnings of everything, right? Article 5 talks about what you have to do, what the personal data must be, how it must be treated. But you know, it's up to you to know what personal data you have, right? I don't remember which article it is actually defines personal data, but the definition is actually pre-GDPR, right? All the way back in 2012, the EU Parliament and its various commissions were speaking to a new definition of personal data, right? Historically, for CISOs, we think about it as PII, right? We think personal data equals PII. And it's actually more than that, right? There's a quote from the European Commission in 2012 where they basically say, personal data is any information relating to the individual. And they give specifics, right? Things that you would expect from a traditional PII definition, like, you know, bank details and email address and this kind of thing. But something as simple as a computer's IP address, posts on social networking, of course, medical information, like it's PII plus these other things, right? Mm-hmm. Something as simple as a name and an IP address is a sufficient connection to count as personal data, according to GDPR. So first step is you've really got to go through and identify what is my personal data, where does it reside, right? That's so critical. And GDPR doesn't walk you through, you must do this, right? But everything it speaks to, you can't be successful if you don't do this, right? Mm-hmm. And the data flow mapping is equally critical. So imagine you've got a complex environment. I think most of us do, right? You've got databases, you've got applications, you've got Windows, you've got Linux. Some of your stuff is in SaaS, you know, like your HR stuff's in Workday, for example. It's all over the place. You're going to have to sit down with these stakeholders, these folks that you brought into the room the first time, and you're going to have interviews. There's automated tools, mind you. There's some great automated tools. There's DLPs that have crawlers that'll walk your network and find personal data as defined by GDPR. There's data classification tools that will crawl your network and find these. And there's some fantastic tools, and they definitely help. Don't get me wrong. My last company built a fantastic tool for this. You know,
wow,
ForcePoint's got a great
tool. Wow.
Yeah, ForcePoint's got a DLP that is phenomenal at this track, at this cause. But at the end of the day, automation's only going to get you so far, because not everything can be found through a crawler. Not everything's going to be found that way. So you're going to be doing a lot of interviews, right? And at the end of the day, what you're saying is, you know, someone sits down, and that someone should be the DPO, the CISO, maybe both, or somebody from their teams, right? And you start with your first customer, like, hey, HR, let's sit down and have a chat. Walk me through your day. If somebody applies to be hired, let's start there and let's walk through the entire HR life cycle of somebody's data, you know, from the moment they approach the company to the moment they leave the company and sustaining, you know, what is that? And walk me through, what do you do? Well, I go to this system and I type in this. Okay, this system and type in this. So now we know this type of information resides in this particular system. Now, sitting at the table with HR are the IT people. Hey, IT guy. What is this system? Is that a database? Is that a Linux file server? Is that, where does this stuff, it's a database. All right, okay. So now what we're saying is HR types in this data resides in a database on this server. Got it. On to the next question. You know, what do you do then? Well, I type this and type that and an email gets sent. Oh, okay. So the data travels by email and you're asking the same questions and you're drilling in and you're drilling in and you're drilling in. And what you get to finally is a really complex personal data map of your entire organization, and you know where this stuff resides. And now it's time for now that that part's done, that's the ugly part. Now it's just time to do standard CISO stuff, right? Okay, now I have to protect this data. And this is probably a good time to bring up, there's some controversy out there. One of the problems with GDPR is it's an ill-defined regulation in terms of some of its detail, right? You'll hear folks say, I've heard people say to me, no one can be GDPR compliant because it's impossible. I've heard people say nobody can be GDPR compliant because no one has any clue what that actually means, that the law is so vague you can't comply, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the big sticking points, one of the single biggest places where people get hung up is around encryption. Is encryption strictly required by GDPR? And I think it's important at this point, by the way, I should have done this at the beginning of the conversation. I should have put this out there. I'm not a lawyer. I am not speaking to legal interpretation on your behalf, right? Consult with your legal professionals anything about interpretation of GDPR. Don't rely on one man's opinion who happens to be a CISO, right? This is really critical that you understand this. This is definitely law and legal we're talking about, and I'm going to venture into areas of what definitely border on legal interpretation. These are strictly opinion. This is the results of my research. This is the results of having talked to other folks. Do your own research. Consult your own lawyers. This is not legal advice. Is that enough disclaiming?
That's perfect. Absolutely perfect.
All right. So now let's talk about the encryption piece.
Yes.
The law says in a few places, the word encryption does actually appear in GDPR. It is not explicitly declared as something you have to have. And so a lot of people have taken this vague, it's only referenced a couple of times and it's not explicitly declared as we don't need encryption, we can get away without. I'll quote one line from the GDPR just to give you some perspective of how it sort of brushes up against but doesn't actually state. This is from Recital 83. In order to maintain security and to prevent processing in infringement of this regulation, the controller or processor, and we'll get into what those roles mean, should evaluate the risks inherent in the processing and implement measures to mitigate those risks, such as encryption. Right. So they don't explicitly say, they say such as encryption. This is a great example of why the encryption thing is a debate. However, when they also speak to things like industry standard practice and all this sort of stuff, we all know as CISOs, come on, industry standard practice, things such as encryption, how are you really going to protect data if you're not using encryption, sure. Right? So at the end of the day, my interpretation is, and again, not a lawyer, not strictly required, but if you don't do it, you're probably setting yourself up for failure. There has been an interpretation that came out in 2014. And remember, GDPR went live in 2018, but was first officially authored and finalized in 2016. But again, as far back as 2012, the EU Parliament was already heading this direction. There's lots of precursor legislation that got laid out, lots of interpretations and rulings that got laid out. So dating all the way back to 2014, we have a ruling from the European Data Protection Board, WP29. And what they basically say is, if the stuff gets breached, even though it's encrypted, right, you've got a problem. It still counts as a breach. But if the data is breached and it's encrypted, and as far as you can tell, nobody has compromised the keys, then you're basically okay, right? And again, this is one interpretation. This is interpretive law pre the official informal GDPR, but it seems to sort of be the de facto behavior and attitude. Okay. Within the Parliament and the Commission, that this is sort of, as long as you're encrypting and your keys are preserved, technically that's not a breach, right? You've done your protection part. So not strictly required, but you should certainly be doing it. Interpretively, it seems to be required is sort of the message on encryption.
So it seems as if then if an organization has in-house counsel, they're going to be driving a lot of this definition when those crossroads are reached.
Absolutely. And if you don't have the inside counsel to do it, then you need to get with outside counsel. And the good news there is there's a bunch of international law firms who have stepped up and really, really just dove on this and are definitely GDPR authorities and experts. There's lots of outside counsel you can consult that can really get you through this. But your own internal legal team should be able to work with it, maybe with a bit of outside assistance here and there. But it is, at the end of the day, a legal matter. And you know, a good legal team should be able to get you through it and get these mandates on the table. And so once your DPO has come to you and said, encryption is a mandate, okay, fine. Now you got your marching orders, you know what to do, right?
So when I go back just a little bit to what you were saying about getting all these folks in the room and you're walking through people through the process, where does this data go? How does it collect it? You know, really defining a process. I look at that as almost conducting a data risk assessment to a degree.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. You're honing in on personal data. And again, you know, more intense definition than the traditional PII definition for sure. You know, and you're having to talk about protection from the perspective of the individual, right? It's a data risk exercise for sure. And it's a data risk exercise on behalf of someone else who's outside your organization, right? That's where it gets a little different. There's really, and I should probably cover this briefly as well. There's sort of four roles involved in GDPR, and I mentioned controllers and processors earlier. So let's kind of cover that briefly.
Yeah.
So first and foremost is the data subject, right? The data subject is basically the citizen of the EU, right? Because at the end of the day, this is a law about protecting the privacy of EU citizens and members of the EAA. And it's a little bit bigger than that, but it's about protecting the data of EU citizens. So at the end of the day, what the government and the EU is really saying is, you know, the data subject, the individual in question, they own their data. It's their data to own. Right. And so you have a responsibility to protect that data if and when you process it in any way, if you contain it, control it, process it, et cetera. Right. So they come up with two concepts, controller and processor, to describe sort of who might be touching the data. The controller is basically, with consent of the data subject, the person, you know, the entity that determines the use and the purpose of the data, right? They're the ones actually, you know, once the subject is given approval, they're the ones determining what's to be done with that data. So for example, the EU citizen is an employee, their data is their sensitive HR data, and the controller is the company who hires them because that's where the HR is happening, right? Then you have the processor role. The processor is processing on behalf of the controller and is under contract with the controller. And just like the controller and the data subject have a, you know, a contract in place, a consent and a contract in place, the controller and processor must have the same. And one of the clauses that exists across all these relationships is essentially the paradigm that the data should only be held and manipulated and managed and processed and flowed and all those things, as long as there's a legitimate purpose and as long as that purpose and continues to be agreed to, right? It's sort of a contractual thing where at any point the data subject can withdraw. Similarly, the controller can withdraw with the processor and say, you know, our legitimate purpose has ended. You no longer have a valid need for that data. You must purge that data. It's important to understand, too, that controllers are beholden and accountable is the right word here for what their processors do. And as you go through this exercise, you're not just sitting down with your HR and your IT and your internal folks, but as soon as you talk about SaaS and right, other type situations like that, you're now having to engage folks that are outside your company. So we'll continue the metaphor. So the data subject is the employee. Remember, the controller is the company because of HR, and the company happens to be a Workday shop. Workday is now the processor.
Yeah. Right?
There have to be contracts between the controller and processor. And yeah, this has gone into in great detail. Article 4 sort of defines what the roles are. And there's all kinds of detail about what these relationships must be. The processor has to protect the data, use it only for the specified reason agreed to. There has to be a signed agreement in place, and they must erase all that data once the specified services are terminated, right? Like it's got to be ended. And similarly, the data subject at any point in the game can do a subject access request, which is basically, hey, controller, what data do you have on me? Where does it reside and what are you using it for? Right. And then there's the right to be erased. I no longer consent. I know I gave you my information last week, but I've changed my mind. I don't think there's a valid business purpose any further, and you have to purge my information. So the controller has to go to his processors and purge it there. And it's, you know, this is all sort of contract is really the way to think of it.
That item right there seems to be a huge sticking point, is when you go to try to erase data, because think about, you have customer service people or financial, whatever, right? People are storing perhaps what is defined as personally identifiable information in emails, in Word documents, spreadsheets. So when you get to that that type of storage of information, how does an organization truly achieve GDPR compliance?
Right. And this is back to that, the most important step, the hardest step, and the longest step is data mapping.
Yeah.
You know, data inventory and data flow mapping. That's what it boils down to, right? You have to truly understand. I don't care if it's structured data or unstructured data, because GDPR doesn't care if it's structured or unstructured.
That's right.
You have to get on it. You have to know. So one of the things you will find is GDPR is a fantastic opportunity for IT teams. It really is. Like there's a plus to all this. You know that system that's been sitting in the corner that you've been wanting to get rid of for 10 years?
Now's the opportunity.
Now's your opportunity. If you can minimize your data footprint, you've taken a huge load off and you've made the whole exercise easier. Like all joking aside, everyone's got that legacy system they've been trying to phase out for a while. This is a fantastic opportunity to say, hey, this legacy system represents this much more cost for GDPR compliance. It's this much more hassle. Couldn't we just bypass it altogether and use this one solution over here that we're already using for this other thing? And now we only have one location instead of two. And, you know, so there's some real opportunity there. And I think that's a key concept to it, too, is you can leverage this. You can, you know, it's not all doom and gloom to try to get compliant.
Let's take a short break and hear a success story from our sponsor, TrustMap, the business management system for security leaders.
Hey, everybody. This is Chad Beckman, CEO of TrustMap. And today joining me is Aaron Pritz. Aaron has spent 17 years in a Fortune 500 pharmaceutical company. Now he runs Reveal Risk. Given his background, Aaron provides a very unique perspective, having managed risk, compliance, privacy, and security strategy across multiple lines of management. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Can you give us a little bit of background information on how you discovered TrustMap and what you see that is really different about it in the marketplace?
Yeah, so I personally had a lot of, I would call it pain and suffering from GRC, and a lot of my industry colleagues had represented the same. So I initially found TrustMap in searching for a GRC alternative, or better said, an alternative to GRC altogether. And I kind of, I would say, accidentally found TrustMap, and really found that it was everything I was hoping to get out of it, out of a GRC, but far more. So I would really use it to simplify both within clients that I work with now, or if I were to ever to go back to a corporate leadership role. I use it to evaluate security programs as well as privacy at the asset level, at the program level. I think it is a strong input into building an improvement strategy, and being able to see where you are doing well and where you are not doing well. And then also measurement and tracking is one of the, I would say, no-brainer things, but sometimes hardest to do. And I think TrustMap provides a really good angle into being able to measure and track commitments against your investments throughout time. And then most importantly, it really provides a way to communicate all of these messages upward to both executive committees and board of directors with some solid visual aids and very simple ways to display progress, goals, and outcomes. And ultimately, you can drop $2 to $5 million over 5 years and a sizable staff to put in one of the legacy GRC offerings, but to me, I would just use TrustMap for most of everything I would need out of the GRC, and everything that GRC doesn't do, which is really a lot of the program and maturity measurement and management that really allows you to move the ball forward.
Great. That's a awesome feedback and perspective based on your experience in the industry. Is there anything else that you'd like to leave our listeners with in considering a solution to do their job better?
I would say focus on business risk. We're in a time right now where a lot of security programs are starting to get funding and starting to have to spend money. And that's not a bad thing. But I think without a plan, without a way to figure out where your risks are from a true business standpoint, not technology, which is a flaw that a lot of us face in the field. But I think really figuring out where you need to go, what you need to do to get there, how you're going to measure it, and know when you get there and what's enough is so critical. Otherwise, we will all drown in a sea of cybersecurity tools that are half implemented or not implemented. I think things like TrustMap are just a wave of the future, and we're going to have to, the future is now if we're going to rationally spend the money that we're getting, and most importantly, to reduce risk.
Thanks, Aaron. I really appreciate the input and feedback. Everyone, that was Aaron Pritz with Reveal Risk. And if you want to get a hold of Aaron, Aaron, how can folks reach you?
Just go out to revealrisk.com and all of our contact information is there, and would love to hear from you if you have any needs.
All right. Thanks, Aaron.
Remember, listeners of the podcast can schedule a free trial of TrustMap at trustmap.com/business. Now let's get back to the show.
I had a conversation with someone from a financial organization just this week, and this subject came up briefly in our conversation. And what the scenario was is, based on SEC and IRS rules and so forth, they have to keep data for a certain period of time, 7 years, let's call it. Mm-hmm. And if somebody comes in and says, "Hey, I have the right to be forgotten. Please forget me." The wild card here is, sorry, we cannot do that.
Because right.
Requirements.
Yeah, I've got law number one says I have to do X, and law number two says I precisely can't do X.
Exactly.
It's not just those guys. I talked to somebody from the airline industry has the same problem. The airlines have to keep around for a certain period of time your flight history stuff, right? And there's various regulations. Yeah, and I think it's, I don't know where that comes from, but my guess was, like anti-terrorism or something like that. But just 3 months ago, did he hop a plane to New York kind of stuff, right? So there's a certain amount of, they have to keep that data around, and they're in the exact same boat. And I'm sure every regulated industry out there probably has a similar story.
Conflicting regulation.
Yeah, and you've got your local regs, honestly, wherever your business is residing, right? You could have city regs, county regs, state regs, national regs, and then you're up against GDPR, which is reaching all the way across the pond. And so at that point, for sure, legal counsel is the way to go, right? I'm not gonna answer that question for anybody. That's strictly a legal interpretation problem. You feel trapped, whatever. One could argue, right? And I've seen people try to argue. I don't know if it's going to stick, if it's going to work, but that valid business purpose phenomenon, it's like, oh, well, there's still valid business purpose here, even though that's now in conflict with the clause of, hey, right to be erased, right? So who knows how that's going to shake out. Leave that one to the lawyers.
Yeah.
But there's another critical piece to all that, which isn't addressed and nobody's thought of. And this is very much a CISO type thinking about GDPR that I'm going to throw out there, because sooner or later, most CISOs will probably catch this one on their own, but know it up front and think about it now. That right to be erased. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm an EU subject. My name is Bob Smith, and I used to work for you a year ago. Okay. And I call you up and say, delete my stuff. I'm Bob Smith. Okay, fine. We'll delete your stuff, Bob. We'll take care of you. All right. But the next day, Bob Jones calls, only it's not Bob Jones. It's Bob Jones's next door neighbor. They've had a dispute going about their fence line on their property for 3 years now. And Bob Jones's neighbor decides, I'm going to get my revenge. And he starts calling everybody. And he starts saying, I'm Bob Jones. Delete me. So think about that for a moment. You've got this requirement. You've got this requirement to delete. And you have no idea who's actually making that requirement, because come on. It's like, So you have to establish identity. You have to. You want to protect yourself. There's got to be some mechanism. So when Bob Jones approaches you, you've got to have some sort of mechanism that establishes to your satisfaction, this really is Bob Jones, because you could get yourself in a ton of trouble if it's not. And the bad thing could happen both for you and Bob. It's bad for everybody if it's not really Bob Jones. So this is a whole nother factor you've got to think about. And this is where it gets really interesting too, because every time I throw this out there, the really clever ones run in front of it and go, well, wait a second. How are you establishing identity? Well, I don't know, notary public, or, some mechanism like that, proof of their, photocopy of their passport, these kinds of
things. Social security number count.
There you go. But the point is whatever you do to establish identity, you've just generated still more personal data on this person. So how do you, you know, it's like, okay, now I have to, now that I've proven it's Bob Jones, I have to wipe out Bob Jones plus the proof I just got that it's Bob Jones. And now I have no record whatsoever, right? And this is another piece of it, no record whatsoever. It's not just that scenario where that comes into play. What if you request to be erased and to be put on the list so that you're never put on the, you know, your information is never used again? Let's say it's a marketing web page. There's an opt-in. This is a real common thing, right? I'm a CISO. I'm thinking about buying a new whatever, a new antivirus solution. And I go over to antivirus.com, you know, the big company. And they got some new white paper about how theirs is the coolest. All they want is your name and your email address, right? So you give them a name, you give them an email address, they email you their PDF, you read their white paper, you move on about your life. And then later you decide, hey, I don't want these guys to have my information anymore because they got my name and email address. I want to be removed. But I not only want to be removed, I want to get with the company and say, hey, you know, make sure I'm truly removed. I want to be on your don't email list. I don't ever want to get contacted by you guys again. There's no valid business reason. I chose your competitor. We have no relationship. Purge me from your system and make sure you never bug me again. How do you possibly make sure no one bugs them again if you don't have their personal info in the do not email list?
Yeah, it's chicken egg situation.
So there's a lot of these little conundrums, right? It's not just the finance and banking guys. It's not just the airlines. These little conundrums exist all over the place. And so there's really, you know, there's a lot of interpretive law that's still to come, right? And that's really what it's going to boil down to.
You know, and you bring up some really interesting situations, scenarios that I haven't heard people talk about yet. I wonder if it will get to a point where it'll become almost a national registry, right? Not for US, of course, but let's say for the European Union, where people are added almost like the US do not call list, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That could solve a lot of this. That could solve a lot of this. And that way that it's the government that has their info only in this one place and for this one purpose. And it's kind of separate from GDPR. Something like that could definitely emerge, would definitely solve a lot of these problems. But it's, you know, it's still, like I said, there's still a lot of interpretation to come, right? We're waiting on the first real fine to be levied. We're waiting on the first real company to be dragged before the commission.
And then the lawyers,
you know, everyone hopes it's not them. But when that first one hits the block, it's going to get really interesting really quickly. There's going to be, I'm sure, the initial defense on anybody's part who gets called in is going to be a refutation of the whole thing, right? Like, oh, this is impossible and preposterous and vaguely worded. And they're going to attack it from every angle they can. And so the interpretation begins and we'll have to see how it all plays out.
There'll be an addendum or it'll be rewritten GDPR 3.0 or whatever the number will be.
Yeah, exactly. And then actually that brings up another real good point too. One of the big questions I get asked all the time is how, you know, I'm an American company. Strictly doing business in the US, you know, how the heck can GDPR affect me? Isn't that some European thing? You know, I don't get it, right? And the answer is multifold. So if you have any kind of company presence in the EU at all, they can get you that way, right? If you've got any kind of legal agreements between two countries, right? Trade agreements, you know, extradition treaties and all these types of things exist between two nations. Any of that kind of stuff can get you, right? So assume first and foremost that the GDPR does in fact apply to you wherever you reside, because at the end of the day, it's a law about the EU's citizens. And if those citizens intersect with you, it's really about protecting them. You know, they're going to hold you accountable as best they can. They're going to leverage relationships with your nation. It's ultimately going to reach you. So lots of folks say, oh, it doesn't apply to me. Assume it applies to you, right?
Even if you're not clearly taking in EU data today, there may be some remnants, or in the future you will capture it.
Exactly.
What is the most common question you get when you present on GDPR on this subject to security leaders, to security teams?
What are my next steps? What do I do? Help me with the practicals and the tangibles. That seems to be where the security folks come into play. Like, so there's lots of work about the interpretation of the law, and everyone has this question, how does it apply to me? We always address that one.
Yeah.
You know, what do they mean by personal data? We cover that. You know, what do they mean by protection? What's this whole thing with encryption? Once you've been through all those sort of high level and basic ones, it really boils down to what the heck do I do, right? And I tell folks it's kind of a three-phase thing, right? There's preparation, there's implementation, and then there's go live and sustain, right? And sustain is sort of its own real critical thing. So what does preparation look like? Establish that DPO, get that role in place, get that person connected up with the CISO, get that going right away, right? And like we said, inventory your data and get your data flow mappings in place, in-house and out-of-house, SaaS or otherwise, like you have to map this stuff. And while that's all happening, your legal team should be furiously working on the contracts, because you're going to have contracts with your data subjects. You're going to have contracts with your processors. And right now, today, by the GDPR definition, you already have a whole bunch of processors who currently aren't under any sort of GDPR informed contract, right? So you've got to backhaul and renegotiate these contracts and get all that in place. So that's all preparatory as well. Once you've got those contracts in play, now the legal team is furiously going through and doing them, working with your controllers and processors and all this business. GDPR also specifies that you have to have DPIA, Data Protection Impact Assessment, performed on every new move you make, right? This is now into the implementation phase, you know. Okay. Any new, this is, you know, for sustaining, think of it as really sustaining phase, but any new effort you launch application wise, you know, data management and processing wise, you have to do a DPIA. So in the implementation phase, get that DPIA and privacy by design, by the way, is also there. So DPIA is Article 35, privacy by design is Article 25. They're both sort of defined. You have to get that preparatory material done at implementation, get ready for all that. And then for sustaining phase, use what you prepare, right? And then, like we said, minimize personal data, data flows, and storage sites. Leverage this during implementation phase. Slash, man, get rid of stuff. The smaller data footprint you have, the less hassle GDPR is. Right? This is a great opportunity to do.
This sounds very much like when we, as an industry, first started to interpret and undertake PCI compliance. It's like reduce the scope, reduce the footprint.
Yeah. Exactly.
System change. You know, it has to be evaluated, and so forth.
Yep. You have to, in every new implementation, you have to think about it through that lens, formally and officially, before you even launch. Think about it through that lens. What am I doing here to protect? Oh, yeah, I should do these things first. And the next time I design a system, I should make darn sure there's no unencrypted data stores and, and those kinds of things, right? So all that happens. You've got your encryption, your password protection, your data monitoring, et cetera. All your usual controls apply at implementation phase. And then you get into sustaining. You're obviously fine-tuning and revising those controls. Your classification is ongoing. New data always emerges, right? And you know, it's interesting here, classification historically, when people talk data classification, they're talking about like the government, you know, secret, top secret, you know, or they're talking about to their company, company confidential, company public, company internal only, you know, these kinds of data classification can easily be leveraged to say personal data, flag and tag this as personal data. You can leverage that same technology for that purpose. And there should be an ongoing and constant effort to always be aware of, hey, wait, that looks like personal data, you know, tag it and make sure it runs through the system, right? And then you've got your ongoing relationship with your data subject, your consent, your subject access requests, your right to erasure, et cetera. And one of the key things here, again, back to the original question was, what does the CISO need to know? Data portability, Article 20. At times, the law is extraordinarily vague and doesn't give you enough detail to work with. And then at other times, it's like, wait, why are they speaking to this in great detail? Yeah. Article 20, data portability, basically talks about when you provide that data to the subject, it has to be provided in an industry standard, machine readable format, you know, on and on and on. They get into some basic details there. Mm-hmm. They don't outright say HTML or XML or JSON or whatever, but, you know, machine readable, standard industry format, easily ingestible data, you know, you're looking at those kinds of things. So for your ongoing and sustaining, you have to be prepared to export in those kinds of formats as well. So that foundation should be laid during implementation, and now in sustaining, you're using that. And then the last and most important piece for the sustaining is the infamous 72 hours to report.
The incident response.
A data breach occurs. Yeah. You've got 72 hours to report that to the authority, right? The supervisory authority. And that's actually, I mentioned before, there's four roles to GDPR. We cover the data subject, controller, processor. Welcome the supervisory authority, role number four. They're the ones who are in charge of the enforcement, conduct the investigations, impose the fines, and they're basically at an EU nation state level. So each nation state has their own. So if the citizen in question is a German citizen, you're going to be up against the German supervisory authority, that sort of thing. So that's the fourth role. You got to be prepared with them. You've got literally 72 hours to notify. From the moment you discover the data got out the door, you've got 72 hours to notify them and let them know the data went out the door. And then you got all the subsequent steps and things related to that. You know, here's what we found. Here's how we addressed. Here's what we're doing to address going forward. All the usual rigmarole around that.
Wow. It sounds like a lot of work the way you've laid this out. What is the average timeline based on having done this once before or seeing others go through it?
You know, It depends on the size of the enterprise completely. Sure. It depends on how able you're able to, you know, how able you are to slash that footprint and get some of your, reduce your data footprint and all these other types of things. But honestly and realistically, you know, you're looking at a year.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds about right. It sounds about right. I would think maturity of the security and the compliance privacy program would also play a key role in that. For example, what you just
talked about,
incident response, right? If you don't have a well-run incident response detection and then data breach response committee, team, whatever you call that, in place, well, that's something net new that you probably should have had in place already, but now you're required to have in place, right?
Right. Incident response has got to be strong. GRC team has to be strong. Data classification program has to be strong. Yeah. Data inventory and mapping, in theory, you've done a lot of that for other projects anyway. If you're starting from scratch, that's a whole nother story there, right? And there's tools to help. Like I said, there's tools to help and reduce. We talked about DLP and data classification crawlers. There's, you know, obviously the manual interviews with all that. Look at your other standard issue tools that you've got in your shop, like CASB. CASB is a great tool for, you know, hey, what are my data flow mappings with my SaaS, you know, entities? How do, you know, my SaaS processors? Oh, look, CASB can tell me what's going on there. You know, network sniffers, firewalls, IDS, DLP. You can use all of this stuff to sort of track and get on top of your flows. For your data protection, again, you may already have a strong play here already going in your shop because you're talking about ultimately encryption, password protection, user accounts, you know, privileged account management, least access, you know, least privilege, you know, all this kind of stuff. So what do you already have in place there? Disk level encryption, file level encryption, database encryption. What about your encryption in transit? Do you already have not lots of TLS tunnels set up everywhere? Right. You know, that's a factor as well. And then I guess, you know, again, strong GRC team, strong legal team. And that sort of, that's your baseline as to how ready you are, how far along are you with all of those things?
That's an excellent summary. Thanks for walking us through that. And I think really providing some, for me, I've heard a lot of talk on GDPR, but this really solidified for me the overall strategy and how to think about it. And I like the way you've broken this down into phases and spoke about how to get started on those activities, rounding up the people in the room and really driving through the data flows and then post-implementation managing. So, you know, GDPR and other regulations as they come out, they tend to really almost force companies to begin taking data protection seriously. With that, now upon us, what do you see happening with our industry over the next, let's say, 3 to 5 years? Where do you believe cybersecurity, information security is going?
You know, at the very beginning of this conversation, you asked about this marriage of security and privacy, which isn't necessarily there. You're talking about legal folks and CISOs, and you know, these are two different realms. I think over the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see a real dissolution of that barrier. I think for one thing, we're going to really see security and privacy just truly cozying up, becoming one and the same. You're going to see DPO type roles that are highly technical. You're going to see CISO roles where they're now looking for somebody with a law degree. I think it's going to be a mishmash of those two. I think you're going to see a lot of blending in that space. What else? In terms of tech, you know, we talk about the protections in GDPR. You know, blockchain is interesting here, right? Because at the end of the day, you're talking about data flow, right? And blockchain is all about encrypting a flow over time, even though there's multiple parties involved, ensuring integrity over a flow. You can see some obvious analogies there. I think some blockchain could be a real play there. What else? Just in general in the industry, you know, automation, machine learning, UEBA, I think we're going to see a real surge of all of that type of technology applied to everything in security. Right, it's real popular right now with SIM.
Yeah,
you know,
that's the most natural place for it to begin.
Well, and that's a natural place if you want to talk about observation only. But you know, my former employers, for example, have started applying it to protection. Right.
Yeah.
So think about the CISO at 2 a.m. getting the wake up call, or the CISO at 8 a.m. getting the notification that in 2 a.m. the decision was made and the problem was solved overnight. And, hey, by the way, here's your alert. If you need to reverse it, you know, maybe you made a mistake, but it was only a 6-hour mistake and it was only for that one guy, but you got to sleep in, right? So that's huge. I think driving enforcement with those kinds of technologies is coming. I guess that's my 3 to 5 year prediction.
No, that's excellent. I think you're, you know, from what I've seen and hear, that's probably exactly where we're going. That and the, you know, the risk officer role merging into that realm, probably not one person, but it's certainly a trifecta of the group.
Yeah, yeah, so, agreed. I think you're going to see more risk officers. And, you know, I know one CISO who's actually predicted the death of the CISO because of that phenomenon, right? The idea that, hey, at the end of the day, security is just another flavor of risk. And if you're really going to have a risk officer and take this from a pure risk standpoint, it's pretty easy to say, oh, that CISO role kind of rolls up into that. Yeah. I disagree. I think security still represents its own unique flavors of risk well enough that somebody has to be there to translate it to the board. I don't think the CISO role is going away, but that's an interesting theory, right? It's certainly something to think about.
Mm-hmm. It depends, I think, ultimately with what you just said on technology, how automated can we make everything else, right? Because you can't be an expert across multiple domains. You have to really be focused on a couple.
Right.
Technology, risk management, for example, privacy and technology. All right. So now, if you could change the world, if you could change our industry, roll the clock back, if it were, or suddenly create a magical solution, whatever it might be.
Right.
What is that one thing that you would say, hey, let's do this better by X, Y, or Z?
Yeah. So I probably have a million answers for that, and they're probably all coming from a completely different facet of the whole show. I could speak to some technology bridges that should be there. I could speak to some let's dissolve the bifurcation between this and that and the other. Right now, these days, what's much more on my mind is not about the technology, is not about the internal implementation. It's not about selling security to the board. It's not about any of the internal physics at all. It's actually about the vendors. I've been very busy on LinkedIn of late. I don't know, for those
who follow me on LinkedIn. Yeah. It's good conversations out there.
There's a lot of conversation taking place, and I'm generating a lot of hubbub, we'll call it, because I'm really poking and prodding at how do the CISO and the vendor interface and interact, and where's the smart play there that benefits all parties? You know, vendors are, most CISOs, to be quite honest, we regard vendors as a nuisance, right? They bug us, they hound us, they harass us, they come at us, and they, who knows what they're actually offering or how good it really is. Do I have the 15 minutes they're all asking for? No. If I gave the 15 minutes to everybody, that's all I would do, 60, 80 hours a week.
Yes.
So that's kind of the default assumption on a CISO's part. And yet, and this is the really interesting thing, and I was just talking about this in a podcast earlier this week. When I was in the security industry, I knew everything about the security industry. Industries are self-aware. Right. Mm-hmm. When I was at Polycom, I knew everything going on in the realm of video conferencing. I could tell you who the new players were, who the competitors were, who was overpriced, who was underpriced, who had the Cadillac, who had the Hyundai. Yeah. I knew all these things. Right. And when I was in the security industry, it was the same story there. Even, products and areas in which my company didn't even participate at all, I could still tell you who the dominant players were, what the new technologies were, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Industries are self-aware. When I left the security industry, it became painfully obvious to me that I really lost that pipeline, that I lost that flow. And so this is sort of the driver behind all these experiments I've been doing on LinkedIn, like inviting the vendors in, welcoming them, but dialoguing with them about here's how to best interface with me. Here's what I need from you. If you're going to make a pitch, literally one of my posts, and that post got like 80,000 views or something, 86,000 views. It's way up there now. And it was basically like, if you're going to hit me up on LinkedIn, I literally want the following format. One sentence that's, who you are. One sentence that's why you're differentiated. One sentence that, and I walked them through this very simple method, and a bunch of vendors actually listened and did that and came to me with that approach. And it was amazing. Budget season is here in another couple of weeks, and I knew budget season was coming. I've got my baseline. I've been with the company 2 months. I know where I stand. I know what's strong and what's weak and where I want to expand and where I don't have a technology at all or where I'm dissatisfied with the tech. And I know what all my default assumptions would be for those different areas. I know what I would purchase and, I'm going to go with this solution over here and that. And I thought, rather than always doing what I've always done, where is the learning, right? Where is that pipeline of what's new in the industry and what's shaking and what's different and all those things I used to get as a matter of course, just being in the building. I'm having to rely on my vendor community to provide that same pipeline. So I've had to rebuild that pipeline sort of artificially. And, I guess my number one, what would I change? This is an awfully long, rambly answer. My number one, what I would change is really vendors, learn how your CISO wants to be interacted with, because you do provide value in ways that he's probably not willing to acknowledge if you're not coming to him in a way that he needs, right? Don't spam me. Don't cold call me. Don't hit me with the, hey, I'm replying to my earlier email. And I go look and there's 80 emails deep and I never talked to you. I never replied to you. You're just replying to your blind that sends over and over and over and over. I get these all the time, right? So learn how the CISOs want to be engaged. Learn what their needs are. Make sure you've got an elevator pitch, a literally 30-second pitch on why, oh, hey, you got that problem. I address that problem. And here's why I'm the one you want to go with in addressing that problem versus my competitors. It should be that short and that sweet. If vendors can learn how to do that, I think CISOs can benefit tremendously across the board. I think vendors become less of a nuisance and more of an information supply pipeline. And I think it can benefit everybody.
Great answer. That literally could be an entire podcast, what you just covered, but I love it. And maybe we'll earmark that for later in the year. Thank you, Alan, for sharing your insights on GDPR and specifically what you just indicated on the vendor discussion. Really appreciate it. As a vendor myself, I know having some of that honest feedback is probably the most valuable information you can gain. So if you're a vendor out there listening, take that to heart. And Alan, thanks again. And I wish you a great week ahead.
Well, thank you. It was great to be here.
Thanks for listening to the Business of Security podcast. A special thanks to today's guest, Alan Alford. Our host today was Chad Beckman, founder and CEO of Secure Digital Solutions. Connect with Chad on LinkedIn and learn more about Secure Digital Solutions online at trustsds.com. Our next podcast episode features George Finney, Chief Security Officer at Southern Methodist University. You've been listening to the Business of Security podcast, and that's a wrap.